We're in Genesis chapter 39. Sometimes the fear in preaching passages in Genesis is because some of them are obscure. They're passages that are difficult because we don't talk about them often. We haven't discussed them very frequently. Sometimes the difficulty or the tension is on the opposite side of the coin, in that they're so familiar that what do you say new that you haven't heard before? And the goal isn't to say anything new that you haven't heard before. The goal is to remind you of what you know and to encourage you to keep doing what you know to do. Genesis chapter 39, we're going to read the whole passage and we'll begin working through this together this morning. Genesis 39, beginning in verse 1, the Bible says, "Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. He was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him. The Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had, in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. Because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. He has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?' And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, 'See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house.' She laid up his garment by her until the master came home. She told him the same story, saying, 'The Hebrew servant whom you've brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house.' As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, 'This is the way your servant treated me,' his anger was kindled. Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made it to succeed." Every occupation has its own ways of taking advantage of the uninitiated. I think I've told you before that I worked for a contractor, and I worked alongside a seasoned carpenter. He had been a foreman back in Washington. I was early informed as I was working with them of some of the pranks that they would play on the new guys who were on the job, such as the time they'd send them to get the board stretcher. And they'd come back with chains and hooks and say, I really, what are you looking for? They have no idea. I remember the time that my boss sent me to the truck to get a hammer for. I said, what's a hammer for? Why, for pounding nails, of course. What do you use a hammer for? He thought that was really funny. Over time, I learned that the tool was not necessarily defined by its design purpose. Thus, when a screwdriver was at hand and needed to be a chisel, it was called a screw chisel. When you were working in a bathroom and something needed to be persuaded into place, he would ask for the crescent hammer and use it as a hammer. Tape hammers didn't last very long for either purpose, of measuring or for functioning as hammers. When we come to the story of Joseph, we need to look at it in its context, both of Genesis and even in the context of this passage itself, because its design is going to speak to us of its purpose. The question is this: does this text, chapter 39, primarily serve as an example of integrity? If so, then we need to use the text according to this purpose. But if that's not the primary design of this text, even though it can be used in this manner, its purpose may be something other than the purpose for which we commonly use it. Is this just to help us see ourselves through temptation? I like the way one writer put it. The purpose of this text is not to get you to think in that time of temptation, what would Joseph do? That's not the purpose of this text. The purpose of this text is to point out your need, like Joseph's need, for the grace of God to be at work and operative in your life. This text comes right after the story of Judah, a story of abject failure spiritually. And we see that God is working in the life of Judah, one who falls into temptation without much prodding, without much coercing, without much encouragement. And God is at work in the midst of the story of Genesis chapter 38. On the flip side, God is in the midst of the story of Genesis chapter 39. But the whole point of the story isn't so much the integrity of Joseph as it is the integrity and sovereignty of God. As we've seen throughout the book of Genesis, God is the hero of these stories. The integrity that's showcased in this particular narrative isn't so much Joseph's as God's own. We have the strange idea that we ourselves are the central character of our own stories. But the truth that Genesis provides us is that we're no more central to our own stories than Joseph is to his story. So as we look at this story this morning, I'd like to point out that the integrity of God's sovereignty is defined by his purposes, not by my circumstances. And that's what we see when we come to Genesis chapter 39. I think what we'll see as we go through this text this morning is that there's three facets that are provided concerning God's integrity regarding his sovereignty. The first is that in these first six verses, the integrity of God's sovereignty is seen in his presence and his purpose to bless his people. As we begin this section, it picks up very well, if we were to go back to chapter 37, verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph into Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. We could very easily skip from the last verse in chapter 37 right to the first verse of chapter 39 and say, now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, yada, 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 yada. And the story could just continue. God in his sovereignty wanted to showcase his mercy and prepare us for his work in the midst of what we would call something rather gross, something rather ugly on the human board as this story is being played out. Now he brings us in chapter 39 to the place where Joseph's been brought down to Egypt is the phrase. The idea is he's no longer in Canaan. Canaan, the land of blessing. Remember, as God's been promising Abraham a blessing, there were two aspects of that blessing. One was the seed, through whom all nations on earth would be blessed. The second part of God's blessing was the land. The land was one of those things that it was wrestling for. Would Esau get the land? Would Jacob get the land? Would Ishmael get the land? Would Isaac get the land? The land was in tension for a long time until finally we see that Esau settles down south in Edom and Jacob rests in the land. And so that question has been settled in the text thus far, but now all of a sudden, Joseph's no longer in the land. Joseph's no longer in the place that God is blessing. And that's going to set up some consternation for this early patriarch. What do you do when you're no longer in the place of blessing? You ever been there? You look back on your life, maybe through some disappointment. Maybe it's a sin of your own. Maybe it's by no choice of your own. And that's where Joseph is. By no choice of his own, all of a sudden life doesn't look like it looked like just 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. Something major has happened. You found out that you're struggling with something that the doctor just laid on you, and you've got no idea, what do I do with this? All of a sudden, I'm in Egypt. I'm no longer in this place of blessing. And now what do I do? This is new territory for me. I've never been in this place before. But the repeated theme over and over and over again in this chapter is that God remains with his people. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. Look at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph. Verse 3. His master saw him, that the Lord was with him. And then all of a sudden we have what that looks like, the blessings that go with it. And we see that God is still blessing his servant there down in Egypt, in this new place by God's design. That God shoved him out of his corner of comfort and he brings him down into this place where it looks like he's separated from God's blessing. But God didn't forget him. In fact, God went there with him. We're going to go through the story, the middle section of the temptation and his success in it, then into the prison cell. And as we wrap up this passage, we see down again in verses 22 and 23, verse 21, the Lord was with Joseph. Verse 23, because the Lord was with him, whatever he did, the Lord made it to succeed. The whole point is that God is with Joseph in the midst of his removal from the land of blessing into that land of bondage, slavery, seduction, of lying, of lack of integrity of those around him. God is with his servant. The first time we see this idea of God being with somebody is with regard to Ishmael back in chapter 21, verse 20. And because God was with Ishmael, it looked like Ishmael was going to die. He's under a bush. He's without any water. The sun is scorching him. His mother thinks to death. But God is with him. And because God is with him, he has God's blessing. He has God's protection. He has God's eye. He has God's attention. He has all the resources of God at his disposal. Well, when you think of it like that, and you're reading the story, it's like, well, Joseph's not in that much trouble. Ishmael's not in that much trouble. We find this phrase being used of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of Joseph, of Moses, of Joshua, of Gideon, of Samuel, of David, Solomon, Hezekiah. All these people, God is with. And as soon as you see that interjected into the narrative, God was with, you know things are going to be okay. Why? Because God's with them. It's like the kids out on the playground. My dad's bigger than your dad. Yeah, well, my dad's bigger than your dad. Well, we'll see. Let's get our dads here. Here's the point. All of a sudden, dad shows up. Things are going to be okay because dad shows up. Whenever you see that line interjected into the story, whatever story it is, whosever story it is, God was with... means things are going to be okay. Because that person has access to all the resources of none other than God. Okay, so it's easy for us to understand this when we're reading through the Bible. We're in our devotions in the morning, we've got our first cup of coffee, and God was with Joseph. Yeah. Okay, so the story is going to turn out okay. But take yourself off the pages of Scripture and plug it into 2015. Now write your circumstances into the story. And then include, and God was with Carrie Briner. God was with Jim Clark. God was with, and you write your name in that blank because that's what the Bible says. God has told you, believer, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And we come to the middle of our stories and we're like, oh, I've never been here before. I'm away from the place of blessing. I remember when God used to bless me and now what? God's still with you. It looks like a different place, but guess what? God's promise to you is that I will never leave you nor forsake you. And that's where the story starts for us with Joseph. The thing is that God is with his servant despite being removed from the place of his blessing. And God makes the place of his servant the very place, the focal point of his blessing. In fact, it's God's presence that is the source of God's blessing. In verse 2, look how it connects these ideas. The Lord was with Joseph and what? He became a successful man. The two concepts aren't separated. There's no period in the middle. It's this is true, therefore this is true. God was with him, therefore he was successful. Okay. Look at verse 3. His master saw truth number 1. The Lord was with him. And truth number 2. The Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. This word success is a key term in this whole story. Verse 23, in fact, is going to end with this word, again, connected to the fact that God is with his servant. Look at verse 23. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's hand or Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it to succeed. This word succeed has the idea sometimes of prosperity, sometimes of victory. Well, Joseph's story at this point doesn't look a lot like victory. Verse 1, if we were to read it again, it says, Potiphar bought Joseph from the hands of the Ishmaelites. Big whoop-de-doo. So he goes from being the slave of one person to being the slave of another person. Well, thank you very much. Okay. Now, it's a particular person who has some influence, who has some wealth. It's going to be a much nicer condition. But the condition remains the same, that he's still a slave. But the whole point is that God is going to give him success in this place that, by God's design, looks as though it's a place of regress rather than success. It looks like a place where he's going to drown, where he's going to be buried, where he's going to be forgotten, where he is going to be written off and out of the story. You ever felt like that? Man, there was a time when I had these dreams that God was going to use me. And Joseph had those dreams, remember? Literally. God had given him two separate dreams. That, Joseph, I'm going to use you. I want to use you. I'm going to bless you. And all of a sudden, he finds himself in this place where, guess those dreams are dead. Guess the only one I was fooling was myself now, wasn't I? Because now I'm in that place where I'm just going to be written out of the story. Nobody's going to remember, least of all God. That's not true. As we come to this story, as it's told here in Genesis chapter 9, the point is that Joseph's success is God's doing, not Joseph's. Do you hear what he said? The whole point of Genesis chapter 39 isn't that Joseph's successful. The whole point is that Joseph is successful by God's doing, not Joseph's doing. Now, he was obedient. He did what he was supposed to do. But the point is that God helped Joseph to succeed in everything, including the temptation. That's important, folks, because you know what? Joseph was a sinner just like you and me. Joseph was made out of the same stuff just like you and me. Joseph had the same temptations just like you and me. The only way Joseph did what he was supposed to do was because God was working through him. And the only way that you can do what you're supposed to do isn't like by being like Joseph. It's depending on the same God that Joseph depended on in that moment of temptation, of trial. The whole point of this passage is Joseph's success is God's doing, not Joseph's doing. The structure of this story is shaped as a chiasm. A chiasm is the idea, it's a cross. From the Greek word chi, which is a letter, it means X. And this passage kind of X's in the middle. It starts with the idea, it ends with the same idea. The beginning six verses start with God's divine presence and blessing. In the middle, we move to human injustice and suffering. And we come down to the end of the story, we see again God's divine presence and blessing. And the whole point of this is that God is the one who's making this work. One Hebrew scholar calls this the most elegantly symmetrical episode in all of Genesis. And it fronts the work of God, even as God's servant is successful. Significantly, the whole idea that closes this chapter is the idea of his success. The final word, his success, his victory. In the place where it looks like he has no victory, he gets victory. In fact, God uses this very circumstance, a circumstance that looks like it's working against Joseph, to bring about a very specific fulfillment of a promise that he had given to Abraham. Remember back in chapter 12, God had told Abraham that I will bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. And through you, every family on earth will be blessed. Okay? So let's look at verse 5. From the time that Potiphar made Joseph overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed whom? He blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on what? Who's the he here? All that he had. Who's the he? Potiphar. God's blessing was on this pagan slave owner. Why? Because he's fulfilling the promise that he gave to Abraham so many years ago. God uses something that looks upside down and backwards as far as his people is concerned to accomplish the very thing that he had promised earlier in the story. That's so often the case. God uses something that looks like it just could never fit. But one of the things that I always forget anyway, is that my story is never primarily about me. I'm a little arrogant that way. But I tend to have this inflated idea of myself that I'm the center of my own story. And God says, you know what? I love you. But I've got a story that's a little bit bigger than just you. And I'm so thankful that he does. Because sometimes when those things that look backwards and upside down and just don't have a place that fit in my conception of what my story is supposed to look like, it's because God's doing something bigger in his bigger story. And he's using me in a way that will bring glory to him. And all I've got to do in those moments where it just doesn't make sense is hang on. Because my God's sovereignty is still intact. Even though my circumstances don't look like he is. God uses these adverse circumstances to bring about the necessary character in his servant. You know, God's blessings aren't always, in fact, I think we can say they're rarely material. We like it when they're material. We like it when the stuff we're able to accumulate. We like it when we're able to put our hands. We like it when things don't break. They work the way they're supposed to. But God's blessings aren't primarily, in fact, they're rarely material. The things that God is doing to build up treasures in my life don't fit on planet Earth. He's building character. He's putting stuff into me so that I can build up a treasure that's laid aside in heaven where the moth and the rust don't corrupt. Am I thankful for that treasure? Well, certainly. But sometimes not as much as the stuff that I'd rather get my hands on. But God is using these very circumstances to refine the character in his servant. And Joseph, who one day is going to rule not just over his brothers and his mother and father, he's going to rule all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh himself. The first person Joseph has to rule is his own character. It's himself. It's the idea that we looked at this morning in the book of Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 28, where it says, another reference is Proverbs 16, verse 32, "The one who is better than the mighty is he who rules his spirit than taking a city." If I can control myself, and that's what Joseph had to learn. He had to learn to control himself before he had the right and the privilege to have authority over others. Warren Wiersbe says, "Had Joseph stayed home with his pampering father, he might not have developed the kind of character that comes only from hard work and obeying orders." We need that, don't we? We need to be put in those positions where we learn how to follow, where we learn the necessity of following, where we can't have the better answer. We might think that we do, but we need to put ourselves under before God entrusts us with that position of authority over others. We see that the integrity of God's sovereignty is fronted by the fact that he has a purpose to bless us, and his presence is his blessing. Secondly, we see that the integrity of God's sovereignty enables the faithfulness of his people. In verses 7 through 20, we have this sordid story. Sexual in nature, as grimy as it gets. But it's a successful story. This is how temptation is supposed to be dealt with. But the only way that we can properly deal with temptation is because of the integrity and the faithfulness of our God. Who was behind Potiphar buying Joseph? Answer: God. Okay? I like how one writer said, if God had wanted to, could God have made Mr. Potiphar and Mrs. Potiphar happily married? Okay, so he could have done that, but God in his sovereignty decided not to let that be the case. We come to the end of verse 6. It says, "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." And all those guys kind of think, yeah, kind of looks like what I look like when I see myself in the mirror. Okay? That was an appropriate laugh. Thank you. Okay? Joseph is plagued with his mother's beauty. Okay? Here's the thing. Who made Joseph attractive? God did. Whose fault is this temptation? Who's sovereign in this temptation? God is. Okay? God tempts no man. God cannot be tempted with evil. Neither tempteth he any man. But God is sovereign over every temptation. We looked at the verse this morning. God will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able. For every temptation that you suffer is only common to man. Okay? If God wanted it differently, he could have made Joseph ugly. But he didn't. Okay. Joseph is right in the middle of where he's supposed to be. And the sovereign working of God does not eliminate man's responsibility. It necessitates man's responsibility. The focus of this text draws our attention in several different ways, on different focuses. I want to look at these very quickly. One of these focuses is on the master-slave relationship, the idea of authority and responsibility. The idea of Joseph's master is found in verse 1. Where this guy bought or purchased him from his masters, the Ishmaelites. Verse 2, It says that he's in the house of his Egyptian master. Verse 3, his master saw him. Verse 4, he had to attend to him. It's his house. It's his stuff. It's his house. It's his stuff. It's his house. It's his... You kind of get the point. Okay? Joseph is servant. Potiphar is master. Joseph has responsibility. Potiphar has authority. And over again, there's this idea of master-servant relationship. The interesting thing is, when we come down in the middle of the story, verse 7, after a time, his master's wife gives him a command. It's an imperative. You must do this, slave dog. Verse 8, but he said no. At the heart of this story is an understanding. Ian DeGede puts it this way. Joseph saw clearly that the choice that faced him in that instant was between satisfying his master's wife by offending God or satisfying God by offending his master's wife. Don't you love it when life is simple? I mean, not as in it's not tough. It's just that it's not complicated. Okay, this was a tough choice that Joseph had to make. But it really was a simple choice. It's defined this way. Which one's my greater master? Okay? Is this one who bears the title, who's telling me to do something that I ought not to do, is that my primary master? Or is my ultimate master God? And Joseph makes the right choice. He does. And we're supposed to make that same choice with him. It's not that we shouldn't learn from this. We ought to. This is exactly what we need to come to the conclusion that Joseph came to. How can I sin and do this great wickedness against my God? But even that choice at the end of the day is God's working in our hearts and lives. Joseph had a responsibility. The focus in the text is on the master-slave relationship. There's a focus in the text on the word hand. We don't see it in the ESV translation, but at the end of verse 1, he bought him out of the hand of the Ishmaelites. The idea is that in their hand is the power of his life. Okay? As it continues in verse 3, it says, the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hand. And it's actually a singular noun there. It's in his hand. And succeeded. In verse 4, it says, he put him in charge of all that he had. It's the idea of putting in his hand all that he had. Verse 6, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. The idea is that what's in your hand, you're responsible for what you do with. Some of you have different things than I have in my hand. You've got different responsibilities. But whatever's in your hand, you're responsible. God's sovereign, God's at work, God's putting stuff in your hand. But who's responsible for what happens with it once it's there? That's you. What are you going to do with God, with what God's put in your hand? God sovereignly put it there. Now it's become your responsibility. What are you going to do with it? We're going to see a contrast in verses 12 and 13. Where Potiphar's wife, through this whole thing, she doesn't have a name. Insultingly, later in the story, she calls Joseph just the Hebrew slave. But she's the one who doesn't have a name through this whole thing, just his master's wife. Interestingly, we're going to see that the thing that's left in her hand, it's left there because she took it. And what does she do with it? She lies about it. See this? Now you come to your own conclusions, but let me tell you what happened. Joseph, in everything that's entrusted to his hand, God says, I made everything succeed. Who's responsible for what's in my hand? You with me? You awake? Okay. Who's responsible? I'm responsible for what's in my hand. Who makes it succeed, whether I make the right choice or the wrong choice? God. You're responsible with it. But the success of what you do with that is God's doing. You understand? That's the point of this story. Joseph makes the right move. But he doesn't succeed because he makes the right moves. He succeeds because God causes him to succeed. But he's responsible for it nonetheless. The text focuses on one key word. That word is all. Verse 3. The Lord caused all that he did to succeed. Verse 4. He put him in charge of all that he had. Verse 5. He was over all that he had. End of verse 5. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had. He uses a merism, both in the house and in the field. There's no realm of his possessions that God did not bless. Down in verse 8, as he's recounting his responsibilities to his master's wife, my master has no concern regarding anything, because everything is in my charge. You come down again to the end of the chapter, verse 22. He put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners. Verse 23, he paid no attention to all of anything that was there in the prison. We're responsible for how much of what God puts in our hands. All of it. There's not a thing that God's entrusted to you that you're not responsible for, including the temptations that come your way. As you come down to the middle of this text, it focuses on a dialogue. For Mrs. Potiphar, it's two words, a command. Lie with me. Two words in the Hebrew. Joseph, we get 35 Hebrew words, some 60 words in the English language. He says, I can't, and here's why, and this is a really important thing. Okay, in the context, all of her words are behind the scenes. They're not in context with Joseph. It's telling everybody else and making Joseph look bad. But the key point is, for her, at the moment of decision, two words of temptation. Joseph, 35 words of no, can't do it, not going to go there, here's why, impossible. At the end, she spends her time telling everybody why this needs to be this way. You know how many words we get of Joseph talking to anybody afterwards? Not a one. We don't get to hear from Joseph after that temptation moment. But we find out all we need to from his mouth. Basically, the context is this. Joseph tells her in verse 8, verse 9, my responsibilities belong to me at my master's discretion. I don't have these responsibilities by my own taking, by my own choosing. These were given to me. They're given to me by my master. Big M, little M. Potiphar or God? Both. Okay. I have my responsibilities in my hand because my master put them there. My master. He says, and the thing that he didn't put in my hand was you. So for me to take what's not been given me, that is you, is great wickedness. It has the same feel of what was happening back in Genesis 6, verse 5, where the wickedness of man was great and God's ready to destroy the earth because of it. I can't do this. I can't take what doesn't belong to me. But the gravity of this wickedness is that it doesn't just affect my relationship with my small M master, Potiphar. You're his wife, for crying out loud. He says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against my master? At the heart of what's going on in this story, Joseph's refusal is possible because he's convinced that God has his hand on him for a special task, that he fits a specific part of God's program, and he doesn't know exactly what it's supposed to look like. He just knows that he belongs to God. And he's convinced of the fact that God has been prospering him and giving him every responsibility that he has to this point. Points this. Ross puts it this way. One cannot sin against God if you're convinced of becoming a significant part of God's program. But oh, how easy it is to sin when you think that God's written you off, when God shoved you onto a shelf, when God's forgotten about you, he's done with you, you're washed out. And that's what Satan would love to have you think. God's done blessing you. Forget it. Well, then sin just becomes a cascading roller coaster. That's where we fall into the addictions. That's where we just want to find something that numbs the pain of being forgotten by God. But the truth is that when we're convinced that we have a place, that we have a purpose, how can I sin? After all that he's done for me, how can I sin? No one can fulfill his or her divine destiny by disobeying God. A third facet of God's sovereignty, his integrity in his sovereignty, means that the faithfulness of God's people doesn't go unnoticed. We've said that the primary point of this passage isn't necessarily Joseph's success in the temptation. It's God's success in the life of Joseph. Through proper choices, he does the right thing. But God is the hero of this story. But God takes note of the right choices that we make. God doesn't leave those off as though they're nothing in the story. They're a huge part of the story. The closing verses, verses 21 through 23, mirror almost exactly verses 1 through 6. And they note that though everything has changed for Joseph, no longer in high society, no more rubbing shoulders with those who are wearing nice gowns, he no longer is clothed in that robe that's now in Mrs. Potiphar's hand. He's wearing the prison stripes. Everything's changed for Joseph. But the point of these last three verses is nothing's essentially changed. You look at how those verses put it. Verse 21, the Lord continued to be with Joseph. The next phrase, the Lord continued to show him his steadfast love. The Lord continued to give him favor in the sight of men. What had changed? His location. Now he has a prison number, but he's still the same in God's eyes. He's still on his pathway to blessing. And still the point remains that Joseph's success, that is, all of it, is primarily God's doing. It reminds us of Philippians chapter 2, verse 13. For it is God who works in you, both to desire and to accomplish God's good pleasure. So, next time you come through temptation, and you do it successfully, yeah, like, Joseph like me, man, we're like kindred spirits. Shut up. The only way Joseph succeeded, all of Joseph's success, was because God was working in and through Joseph. And all of your success is exactly the same. Because it's God who works in you to desire his will and to do his will. So that who gets the credit? Not me. I was just obedient. I'm just a sinner saved by grace who, praise God, he's still working in my heart. What a blessing. I'm going to read this because it's worth reading. What we miss in the process is the fact that God was not at work in Joseph's life because he obeyed God and resisted temptation, and absent from Judah's life because he gave in to temptation and fell into sin. We tend to think that God surely must have loved Joseph because he was such a hero. Must have been really disappointed in Judah because he was such a loser. We then transfer that thought to our own experience. God really loves us when we obey and we resist temptation. And he hates us, or at least he's really disappointed in us when we sin. It's certainly true that God hates sin, our sin as much as anybody else's. But if there's one lesson that's central to the Joseph story, it's that God uses things that he hates to accomplish goals that he loves. He's not just at work in and through Joseph, but he's at work in and through the life of Judah as well. We focus on chapter 39 because Joseph's the hero. We avoid chapter 38 because Judah's such a loser. But the point of both chapter 38 and 39 is that God's the hero. And whether we fail or succeed, God gets the credit. God gets the glory. The Lord's wonderful plan for us is to show us the messy reality that in life we are desperately in need of God's amazing grace. The ultimate purpose of this text isn't primarily to show us how to succeed at temptation, though it does that for us. The ultimate purpose of this text is to prepare you and me for and to point us to Jesus Christ, the one who manifests perfect integrity out of perfect love for the Father and suffered the greatest injustice of all for you, for me, so that when we don't succeed like Joseph did, we still have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous, who this story points to.